You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures, entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is Lecture 11, given in Dornach on the 16th of July, 1922. In my last talk, I had to point out repeatedly how in European civilization, at the height of the Middle Ages, two currents of thought flowed through the best of souls. Those two currents which I described yesterday as knowledge through revelation and knowledge through reason within scholasticism. Now we had to emphasize that knowledge through revelation, as it appears in scholasticism, is definitely not something mystical or an unclear abstraction. Rather, it is the expression of sharply defined structured concepts. However, it was considered beyond the scope of human understanding, and each person who sought this knowledge had to accept it as transmitted by the Church, which in its traditions and continuity has in a way the right to preserve it. The second current, knowledge through reason, was free to be explored by human beings. But those who were firmly anchored in scholasticism had to recognize that with this knowledge through reason, there is no possibility of attaining knowledge from the supersensible world. Thus, at the height of the Middle Ages, it was acknowledged that what was no longer accessible to the people at the time had to be preserved historically. I have already indicated that this was not always the case. If we go further back through medieval times to the first Christian centuries, then we find that the special character of knowledge through revelation was not so keenly emphasized as was the case in the late Middle Ages. And if, for example, we had shown a Greek of the old Athenian school of philosophy the differentiation of cognition into a mere knowledge through reason and a knowledge through revelation, using revelation here as it was used in medieval times, then this Greek philosopher would not have understood it at all. He would not have been able to find a concept for the fact that when a power from beyond this world communicated knowledge of the supersensible to humanity, that this should be static and could not be communicated anew. The Greeks understood that we cannot attain higher spiritual knowledge through ordinary cognition, but they also understood that through spiritual training, through the path of initiation, we can develop higher cognitive abilities. Then we can enter that world in which we have the possibility of seeing what is truth, what is knowledge in the supersensible. And precisely in this respect, the whole of Western culture underwent a great change from what existed in those centuries in which Greek philosophy blossomed in Plato, in Aristotle, to what then appeared at the end of the 4th century CE. I have often pointed out one aspect of this. The mystery of Golgotha took place in a time in which there was still much of the old wisdom of initiation, of the old knowledge of initiation. And truly there were enough people able to use their initiate wisdom so as to understand the mystery of Golgotha by means of supersensible cognition. Initiates strove to gather all the initiate wisdom they could so as to understand how the Christ being, who before the time of the mystery of Golgotha had not been united with earthly evolution, had connected with an earthly body, and was now united with human development. What kind of a being was this, and how had they acted before descending to the earth? These were questions for which they sought answers using the highest faculties of initiation at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. Then, however, we see that the old wisdom of initiation which existed in the Middle East, in North Africa, but also in Hellenic culture, and even in Italy and farther into Europe, this wisdom of initiation was less and less understood from the 5th century CE onward. Certain names are spoken as if the people they belong to are seen as rather contemptible within the Christian civilization of the Occident, or at least as personalities, a proper Christian should have nothing to do with. At the same time, efforts were made to obliterate all traces of the earlier knowledge that these people had. It is curious that a man like Franz Brentano, steeped in the medieval tradition, inherited the hate people had toward what had existed in the soul of someone like Plotinus, of whom we know very little, but who is seen as a philosopher with whom a true Christian believer should have nothing to do. Brentano even shared this hate of Plotinus. He had allowed himself to inherit this hate. He wrote a treatise titled What Kind of Philosopher Sometimes Makes the Epoch, and he meant Plotinus, the philosopher of the 3rd century CE, who was part of that current of thought, which then completely dried up in the 4th century CE, and which later Christian development did not want to remember. What is written in the customary history of philosophy about the outstanding figures of the 1st centuries CE is mostly not even just a minimum. It is impossible to gain a faintly coherent idea of these people from it. Needless to say, it is very difficult in modern times to get an idea of the first 3 or 4 centuries of the Christian era. For example, how what had lived in Plato and Aristotle continued and lived on in these personalities of the 3rd or 4th centuries CE, even though it was already estranged from the deeper wisdom of the mysteries. In the usual histories of philosophy, you will find hardly any real understanding of Plato. If you are interested in this, then look, for example, at the chapter on Plato in the History of Greek Philosophy by Paul Deussen, where Paul Deussen writes about what Plato thought about the idea of the good in relation to the other ideas. There you will find sentences such as the following. Plato did not assume the existence of a personal God, since otherwise the ideas that he taught could not have existed out of themselves. Plato could not recognize a God-being, because ideas exist independently. However, Deussen goes on to say that Plato places the idea of the good above the other ideas. Only this does not mean that the idea of the good somehow stands above the other ideas as something intrinsically independent. For what the idea of the good expresses, that is just a certain family resemblance that exists in all ideas. Now, we should pay attention and look more closely at Deussen's logic, the logic of one of the most outstanding contemporary philosophers. Plato has the ideas. They are independent. Now, Plato has the idea of the good. This is not supposed to be something which leads the other ideas. Rather, the ideas have a common family resemblance. And this family likeness is expressed in the idea of the good. But where do these familial resemblances come from? If there is a family likeness, if you want to use such an expression, then it must at least come from some kind of parentage. The idea of the good points to a family likeness, hence we must be able to find an ancestor. So this is what we find in preeminent contemporary writings on the history of philosophy. The writers of such things are the intellectual authorities of our times. People learn these things and fail to notice that it is complete nonsense. Obviously, we cannot trust someone who talks such nonsense about Greek philosophy to have much of importance to say about the wisdom of India. Still, today, if you are looking for an authority on Indian wisdom, then you will be referred to Paul Deussen. This is how bad things have become. I just wanted to point out that, at present, there is not much appreciation even of Platonic philosophy. Modern intellectualism is not even capable of this. This is why there is no understanding of what, however, is still part of traditional lore. This is that Plotinus, the Neoplatonic philosopher, this is what he is always called, was a student of Ammonius Saccas, who lived at the beginning of the 3rd century CE, but wrote nothing, only teaching individual students. The outstanding spirits of this time wrote nothing because they thought that wisdom must exist as something living, so that it cannot be transmitted from one person to another through writing, but only from human being to human being in direct personal contact. Now there is something else said of Ammonia Saccas, whose significance people are not clear about. They say that in the face of the awful quarrels between students of Aristotle and those of Plato, he tried to bring them to a consensus by showing how Plato and Aristotle actually harmonized with each other. I just want to describe in a few words how Saccas could have spoken about Plato and Aristotle. On the one hand, he says that Plato belongs to that era in which people could find their own soul path to the spiritual world. In other words, when people still knew the principle of initiation. Perhaps Ammonius Saccas said that in older times, logical abstract thinking had not yet developed. Even now, here I mean at the beginning of the 3rd century CE, there are only the first signs of it. Thoughts developed by human beings did not really exist in Plato's time. But whereas older initiates gave what they had to communicate to humanity in the form of images and imaginations, Plato was one of the first to transform imaginations into abstract ideas. When we envision the mighty contents of these images, and there's a diagram, which Plato wanted to guide people to see, then for older times the content of these images was expressed only in imaginations. But for Plato, they were already ideas. But these flowed down, in a way, from the divine spiritual. Plato said, "The lowest manifestation, in a sense the most diluted manifestation of the divine spiritual, are these ideas." Aristotle no longer had the strong potential to rise up to this level of the spiritual. Thus he only had what was below the level of the images. He only had the content of the ideas. However, he could still understand these as revelations. "There is no difference between Plato and Aristotle," said Saccas, "just that Plato could see into higher levels of the spiritual world, and Aristotle saw only lower levels." Ammonius Saccas thought that with this he could sweep away the differences between the followers of Aristotle and of Plato, and even though at the time of Plato and Aristotle, wisdom was already beginning to appear in intellectual form, there was still the possibility that some people could rise to quite high levels of spiritual vision. And so we have to remember that such people as Ammonius Saccas and his pupil Plotinus were still full of direct spiritual experiences, and especially of such experiences where their vision of the spiritual world was quite specific. Of course, we could not have spoken to such people about external nature as we do today. In their schools, they spoke of a spiritual world, and of nature down below, which today is for most people the whole world, was only the lowest image of the spiritual worlds of which they were conscious. We can imagine how such people spoke if we look at one of Saccas's successors, Iamblichus, who still had deep insights and carried them on into the 4th century CE. Let us imagine how Iamblichus saw the world. He spoke to his students as follows, quote, "If you want to understand the world, then you should not look at space, for space consists of just the outer expression of the spiritual world. Also you should not look at time, for it is only the mirage of the real and true cosmos which appears in time. We have to look up to those powers in the spiritual world which create time and the relationship between time and space. We must look out into the cosmos. Every year the same cyclical course of heavenly bodies takes place, exemplified outwardly by the sun. The sun moves through the zodiac, through the 12 signs. We should not just look at it passively, because 360 celestial powers are at work in all this, and they are behind all the effects the sun produces for the whole of the world, accessible to human beings. And they repeat this cycle every year. If they alone ruled, then the year would have 360 days. Close quote. This is roughly what Iamblichus taught his students. However, there are 5 days left. These 5 days are ruled by 72 sub-celestial powers, the spirits of the planets. I will draw this pentagon in the circle because 1 to 5 is the same relation as 72 to 360. So the remaining 5 world days of the year, which 360 celestial powers would leave empty, are ruled by the 72 sub-celestial powers. Now, as you know, the year does not consist of just 365 days. A few hours are always left over. For these hours, according to Iamblichus, there are 42 earthly powers. Iamblichus goes on. The 360 celestial powers are connected to the human head organization. The 72 sub-celestial powers are connected to the chest, breathing, and heart organization. And the 42 earthly powers are connected to what in humans is the purely earthly organization of digestion, of metabolism. So human beings were embedded in a spiritual system, in a cosmic spiritual system. Nowadays, we begin the study of physiology by learning how much the human being ingests of carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, calcium, and so on. We relate the human being to the lifeless in nature. In his schools, Iamblichus would have described the human being as related to the 42 earthly, the 72 sub-celestial or planetary, and the 360 celestial powers. Just as human beings are now described as consisting of earthly substances, so then they were described as something that flows down from the powers, the agencies of the spiritual universe. We have to say that an extremely exalted wisdom was represented in these schools. We can then understand that Plotinus, who only became a follower of Ammonius Saccas when he was 28 years old, felt that he was now in a different world because he could absorb some of this knowledge. This wisdom was taught in many places in the first 4 centuries after the mystery of Golgotha. And with this wisdom, they attempted to understand how the Christ descended into Jesus of Nazareth. They tried to understand what was Christ's place in this whole mighty world of spiritual hierarchies, in this whole spiritual edifice. Now, I want to talk about another chapter of the wisdom of Iamblichus that he taught in his schools. He said, "There are 360 celestial powers, 72 planetary powers, and 42 earthly powers. Hence, altogether, there are 474 divine beings in diverse hierarchical order." Now, look to the far east, so said Iamblichus to his pupils, where you can see that there are peoples who all have names for their gods. Then go to the Egyptians, and they too will have names for their gods. Other peoples will also name their gods. Then go to the Phoenicians, to the Hellenes, or to the Romans, and again you will find other names of the gods. If you take all 474 names of the gods, then all the various gods of the various peoples are included. Zeus, Apollo, also Baal, Amon, the Egyptian god, all the gods are included in these 474. That the various peoples have different gods is because the one people has taken 12 or 17 out of the 474. The second has taken 20 or 25. The third, 3 or 4, and so on. And when we rightly understand the various gods of the various peoples, then we find 473. And the highest, the most noble of all, the one who at a certain point in time would descend to earth, that is the Christ. It was this wisdom which tended to reconcile the various religions, not from some vague feeling, but rather because they wanted to recognize how, for someone who could distinguish the 474 gods in the whole cosmic edifice, the various divinities of the various peoples are part of a great system, and how this divine Olympus of all peoples of ancient times culminated in Christianity. And this whole edifice was meant to be crowned by the understanding of how the Christ in Jesus of Nazareth had descended into his earthly task. When we look at the spiritual science of those times, which is, however, no longer valid today, now we have to study spiritual science differently, then we are full of admiration for what was taught about the supersensible worlds the supersensible cosmos. However, this understanding of the universe was only transmitted on condition that it was handed down from the older initiates to their immediate students. This wisdom was only to be passed on to those who had been thoroughly schooled so that their cognitive faculties had reached a level where they were able to understand the nature of one or other of these various gods. We can say that everywhere in the relevant circles, this was a prerequisite of spiritual culture, in Greece, in Egypt, in the Near East, but not in the Roman world. However, the Roman world did have some vestiges of the ancient wisdom. Plotinus himself taught for a long time in Italy, within the Roman Empire. But the spirit of abstraction had infiltrated the old Roman world, a spirit which could no longer understand in the old way the value of the human personality or the value of beingness, quiddity itself. The spirit of abstract concepts had taken hold of Roman culture, not as extreme yet as in later times, but I think people clung to it all the more when it was in its rudimentary form. And so we see that as the 4th century CE begins, there is a kind of school in Italy which takes up the fight against the old principle of initiation, the fight against all preparation of individual human beings for initiation. We see a school developing which collects and carefully records all that has been transmitted from the old initiations. This school, which continues on from the 3rd to the 4th centuries, is concerned with perpetuating Roman culture itself, of establishing historical tradition in place of the strivings of each actual individual human being. And Christianity now starts to develop within this Roman principle. Standing at the beginning of that Christianity which originated in the 4th century CE, this school meant to obliterate all that could still be found in the old initiation about the incarnation of the Christ in the person of Jesus. In this Roman school, they were convinced that what Ammonius Saccas taught, what Iamblichus taught, should not be allowed to pass down to posterity. Just as they set about demolishing all the old temples, destroying the old altars, annihilating what was left of ancient paganism, so they tried to obliterate spiritually all the principles which made people able to find the higher worlds. And so, just to take one example, in place of what Iamblichus and Ammonius Saccas knew, that the individual human being is able to evolve up to a level where they can understand how Christus dwelt in the body of Jesus, they substituted the dogma of the one divine nature, of the two natures in the Christ. This dogma was to be inviolable, and insight, or the mere possibility of insight, was to be deeply buried. In ancient Rome, this transformation of the old paths of wisdom into dogma took place, and they were at pains to destroy all the old information, everything that recalled the old ways, so that only the names of such people as Ammonius Saccas and Iamblichus remained. Not even the names of numerous other teachers of wisdom in the southern areas of Europe have survived. Just as all the altars were destroyed and all the temples burned to the ground, so the old wisdom was eradicated, so that people today no longer have any idea of the wisdom that existed in the south of Europe in the first 4 centuries after the mystery of Golgotha. This knowledge at least found its way to people who were interested in such things and who could see how ancient Rome was swiftly heading for its downfall and how Christianity was spreading. However, after what would have enabled a glorious reception of the mystery of Golgotha had been destroyed, it was only possible to see the uniting of the Christ with Jesus as a dogma, determined more or less by the synods of the Church in an abstract Roman way. The living wisdom was extinguished and replaced by the abstraction, which was then regarded as knowledge through revelation. The history of such processes has been more or less wiped out, But at the time, in those first Christian centuries, there were many people who said that initiates, such as Iamblichus once was, do exist. These are the people who talk about real Christianity. For them, Christ is indeed the Christ. But what did the Romans increasingly do? The Romans made of Christianity what we should really call the Galileans. For a while, during the 3rd and 4th centuries, this expression was used to cover up a great misunderstanding. The less people understood about Christianity, the more they spoke of the Galileans. Less and less was known about Christ, and the human personality of the Galilean became more and more important. Into this spiritual environment came the figure of Julian, the so-called apostate, who had absorbed much of what the followers of Iamblichus had to say, and who knew that there is a spiritual cosmos that reaches down into the various realms of nature. Julian, the apostate, had heard from students of Iamblichus how right down into the animal, into the plant, the forces of the 360 celestial powers, the 72 sub-celestial planetary powers, the 42 earthly powers, are at work. In those days people understood such things, as are wonderfully expressed in the legend surrounding the personality of Plotinus, which has a profound meaning. This legend says that there were already many who refused to believe that someone could be inspired by a divine spirit, and said that someone who claimed to know something of the divine spiritual world was possessed by a demon. So Plotinus was dragged before the Egyptian temple of Isis, where it was to be decided which demon had possessed Plotinus. And as the Egyptian priests, who knew about these things, arrived and examined Plotinus in front of the altar of Isis, with all the rituals possible at the time, then, instead of the demon manifesting, it was the goddess herself. So at that time there was at least the possibility of testing whether someone was possessed of a demon or of a benevolent god. Julian the apostate still heard about such things, but on the other hand he also heard about something like the text, which in the first Christian centuries was doing the rounds within the Roman Empire, and which was supposed to be a sermon of the Apostle Peter. However, this was a forgery. This text said that we should look at the godless Hellenes and how they saw the divine spiritual in all natural beings. That is profane and is forbidden. You should not look at nature, at animals, at plants, and see the divine spiritual. You should not stoop to the belief that in the path of the sun, the path of the moon, there is something divine. So Julian the apostate heard these things from both sides, and he developed a deep love of Hellenism. He became that tragic figure who wanted to speak of Christianity in the sense of Iamblichus. We cannot imagine what would have happened if not the Christianity of Rome, but that of Julian the apostate had won the day, if his impulse to rebuild the temples of initiation had won out, so that people could see for themselves how the Christ had dwelt in Jesus, and how the Christ was connected to the other deities. Julian the apostate did not wish to destroy the pagan temples. He even wanted to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, the Jewish temple. He wanted to rebuild the pagan temples, and he also befriended the Christians. He wanted the truth. He was particularly against that school in Rome, which aimed to and succeeded in destroying the old principles of initiation and replacing them with mere recorded traditions of initiation wisdom. And they knew how to arrange it so that just at the right moment, Julian was killed by a Persian lance. It was then that was said what has never been understood, not even by Ibsen, but that now from the tradition of the times we can realize what it means. Not Christ, but the Galilean has won. For in his moment of death, Julian the apostate could see prophetically how the idea of the divine Christ would ebb away, and the, in quotes, Galilean, the human being born of the tribe of the Galileans, would gradually be venerated as a god. in his 30th year in a great prophetic vision. Julian the Apostate saw the whole development of theology that continued into modern times, into the 19th century, and how it completely lost the Christ in Jesus. He was only apostate in relation to what was yet to come. In reality, he was an apostle in relation to what was then a spiritual understanding of the mystery of Golgotha that we must understand again. Newer geological layers are deposited on the old, and we always have to dig through them if we want to reach the older ones. It is difficult to believe how thick these historical layers in the development of humanity are. What has been laid down over the mystery of Golgotha since the 4th century CE under the influence of Romanism is indeed extremely thick. However, with the help of spiritual knowledge, we have to excavate these layers so as to find the ancient wisdom which, like the ancient pagan altars, has been so thoroughly swept away. The Egyptian priests determined that Plotinus was not possessed by a devil, a demon, but by a god. In Western Europe, however, it was determined that it was a demon, after all. You can look all this up, including Brentano's title, What Kind of Philosopher Sometimes Makes the Epoch?, in which you will find that the Egyptian temple priests determined that in Plotinus, the philosopher of the 3rd century CE, it was not a demon which possessed him, but a god. Brentano determines that it was not a god, but a demon. And this is what happened in the 19th century. Gods were seen as demons and demons as gods. And it was no longer possible to differentiate in the universe between gods and demons. This is what lives on in the chaos of our civilization. It really does make you think when you look at these things in the right way. Today I just wanted to describe a chapter of history to you quite objectively, because, of course, all that happened historically was necessary. But it is also necessary that when people had to lose sight of certain things for a certain time, that they just rediscover them and really take them to heart. The end of Lecture 11.